Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 151, The Tibetan Way of Learning and Shakyamuni's Pure Land.
I think people think that it's going to happen like that.
Yes.
Because the Buddha suddenly got enlightened under the tree.
Yeah, but he was starving for 6 years, even in that
right.
life.
Yeah.
Doing nothing but meditate for 6 years, eating no food.
Right. Yeah.
And having no clothes and living in the wild in the winter and the summer and spring, etc. And before that, he was a genius prince educated in every conceivable manner. And then in previous lives, he skips 500 of his life stories. So he would evolve to a certain point, you know. Well, however, you know, some say he already achieved Buddhahood long before, then he just demonstrated these, what are called the 12 exemplary deeds of a Buddha. You know, and it's like the same as in Christianity, you know, you can see Christ as just God's manifestation and therefore just God from the start. Or you see him as a human who's trying to live up to it, you know, and finally says, why have you forsaken me? So fully human, in other words, and not realizing until after he's resurrected that he's God. They have like what they call docetic, you know, different versions of Christianity like that. Same in Buddhism. And anyway, the point is, Buddha didn't say that you can attain enlightenment just like pop. You know, and furthermore, on top of that, in Mahayana Buddhism, enlightenment is not just a mental attainment, it's a physical attainment. The Bodhisattva pledges to pursue the welfare of beings for 3 incalculable aeons, and the number of calculus is something like 10 to the 12th power. It's a lot of zeros. You know, asankhya, it's a number in Sanskrit. They're into big numbers. They're astronomers and cosmologists. And meaning that the body changes by doing altruistic acts, by giving away one's life, by giving away one's head, one's blood, one's eyeballs, one's ears, one's family, one's kingdom, et cetera, et cetera. You can read all these previous things, and this creates a different kind of body. And then in Tantra, this is done in sort of technical way in a virtual state, rather than having to be reborn in the flesh and blood, in the meat space, as John Perry Barlow would call it. Being reborn in meat space, it's very slow, 3 incalculable aeons. But being dying and being reborn, and because death is a way of evolutionarily progressing, because death is where the seemingly intractable, very little changeable solid body gives way, and then it's just a mental body. It's an energy body that can shift and transform its form dramatically, which is where the area Tantra works in, and to accelerate evolutionary development. In other words, it's a physical thing. You know, so the enlightenment is sudden. We got that. Well, there's several presuppositions that we have as Westerners about that, and the first is that. First of all, that enlightenment is just a mental thing. And that makes it seem very easy to us because in the way we don't have a mind, as my guru once told me. You know, Americans, you can't attain enlightenment because the mind attains enlightenment and you Americans don't have one. meaning that you think you don't have one. You're brought up to think that it's just a brain doing something, you know. And these big authorities come and tell you, oh, yeah, you're not reborn. Oh, that's a primitive old religious idea. No, forget about it. and you're just your brain, you know, and when the brain stops, that's the end of it. So then we think enlightenment is just like, I don't know, Kant, 18th century, you know. Well, let's have a French Revolution and chop off the king's head. And that's enlightenment, you know. Or let's figure out that we can, that the, you know, Descartes, you know, the mind is just a point that is an absolute point. A sort of unchanging absolute, like the point, X, Y, Z. So in a way, he drove the mind out of time and space, you know, took it out of time and space, up into some sort of transcendental realm of God or transcendental ego of Kant's, you know, thing in itself, whatever. So, so we just think it's some little click in the mind where you just sort of drop out from some old-fashioned traditional presuppositions like the Western Enlightenment. You know, and then we do democracy or something. And we live for this life to be comfortable. And we get into industrialization. And we conquer the world and exploit its resources, etc. And actually we're destroying ourselves with our genius insight. So that's one. So, but enlightenment, if it's defined as a completely new, you know, evolutionary possibility, it's not a god, it's not a human, it's beyond all kinds of understandable self-centered ways of existing, and it's some kind of something else. It's only, sci-fi is the only doorway to beginning to really realize what it is, enlightenment.
In Western culture.
Huh? Yeah, in this culture, yeah. Sci-fi is a really good doorway. My favorite is, do you remember the sci-fi, the Starship Enterprise movie where they discovered V'ger? You didn't see that one? No, they discovered this berserk computer that they called V'ger because they could see letters V and G-E-R at the end, and then others had been erased. And this computer had a woman's voice, and it was devouring galaxies and solar systems and, you know, completely huge, giant thing, and devouring things. And it was coming to the Federation home planet, and the Starship Enterprise landed on the deck of this huge computer thing, which was about to devour Earth. And then they dialogued with the computer, and they found out that the computer's quest for knowledge was what was the problem. And it wanted to know what it was like to be human. That was his final piece that he couldn't put together in its vast assembly of knowledge about the universe. And so it was devouring humans to try to, you know, analyzing them and ingesting them to try to figure out what it was, but that wasn't helping. So they couldn't get it to stop because it was programmed just to get knowledge, you see, by ingesting everything around it, by merging with it through ingesting it. So what to do? So then, actually a friend of mine, the actor was a friend of mine from my childhood, the experience of working in a restaurant on Martha's Vineyard. Believe it or not, Frank Converse, the name of the actor, he was some kind of expendable captain on the Enterprise, Captain so-and-so. And he volunteered and said, look, to save the Earth, I'll merge with V'ger. And then she'll know what it is to be human, because I'll give up, you know, I'll give my life, I'll let her devour me, or I'll merge with her, you know. And so they offer that. So then they say, no, you can't do that. He says, yes, I'm saving the whole planet and all of you guys. So you can't stop me, I'm going to do it. And they said, okay. Finally they said, okay. Spock said, let him do it. And so Spock tried to mind meld with her before, but it wasn't working. And so then Frank Converse merges with the V'ger. And it's this human-computer merge, you know. And, you know, our concept is we can think of a computer as all-knowing, you know, because that's our technological thing. That we sort of, we have a little opening there to have at least a dramatic credibility of that, right? Then there's that Dr. McCoy, you know, there's Dr. McCoy, Kirk, kind of human irrational, like emotional component. That's the guy, you know. So you have a yabyum, you know, what the Tibetans call a male-female in union of man and computer, female computer, V'ger. And they merge, and she goes, oh. and then the whole material aspect of the machine dissolves, and it just becomes, you just see waves of energy flowing out in the universe because she's totally happy because she sort of knows everything now because she's felt human emotion by somehow, you know, union. Of course, they don't show the abdomen, they should really, but they don't. So that's perfect. That's in and out. Then you can begin to understand. It's like the brain multiplied millionfold, you know. And the way the Buddhists symbolize it is, you know, Buddha has this huge extra scoop, I call it, of brain on top of his head, the Ushnisha. It's a big thing like that. And actually they say that nobody can see the top of it. Except what it really is like an inverted cone head, where it's like it opens like that to all the divine realms and all kind of, you know, the whole infinite universe. So it's a boundaryless embodiment is the idea. It's a body of pure conscious light.
Who programmed Vijaya?
Well, Vijaya turned out to be Voyager, sent out in the 20th century by a bunch of morons in Houston, by Rick Perry and a bunch of the pre-Rick Perry, wherever it was.
Right.
Maybe Ann Richards, possibly. I don't know who was governor of Texas at the time they sent out. So Vijaya turns out to be Voyager. You know. They didn't have Data, or they would have figured it out right away. You know. In that movie, they just had Spock. You know. Yes. But I'm saying, just to conclude, so those sci-fi things, or the Matrix, you know, where the guy, I love the Matrix because the guy who's the one, he merges with the entire program. So he can then affect it in all kinds of ways. He didn't create it, and he can't completely stop it, although he works for it ultimately in the third one, you know, and he gets rid of the guy who's using a similar power, but not quite the same power in a negative way. Right, and then we don't know. Then they were going to do a fourth, but they freaked out because Lawrence Fishburne got too fat and they couldn't figure out how to carry on. No, he was getting all puffed up and he wouldn't first lose weight and he was getting arrogant. So if you are familiar with my Central Philosophy of Tibet book, or originally published as Speech of Gold, The Essence of True Eloquence, the Central Philosophy of Tibet, Princeton University paperback, and in that book, I open a door to what has been my lifelong philosophical work, which is to redeem relativism as the middle way between, or the central way between, absolutism and nihilism. And the problem with contemporary philosophy, which those conservatives are in a half-baked way referring to, is that those kind of people still have not managed to get beyond old-fashioned, you know, Judeo-Christian absolutism. So anything that isn't absolutism is nihilistic. So they use relativism as a synonym for nihilism. And they feel that way. I have colleagues in my department who feel that way. You know, it's got to be something absolute in there, or they're nervous, you know, because they get that from church. And, you know, that's the linchpin of theories arising from the psychotic personality structure, psychological structure, that Buddha's psychologies seek to help us free ourselves from. And connecting it to the thing about conservatives and liberals in this country, you know, it's like gay marriage will weaken the institution of marriage, they say in the red states. They have the highest divorce rate in the country themselves. Their lives are failures, actually, themselves. They are racist, they are sexist, they are violent, they are gun-toting. NRA, if you know the history, is nothing but the seemingly sanitized continuum of the Ku Klux Klan. The very same people, John Birch Society, Ku Klux Klan, and NRA. It's just one straight historical story, no doubt about it. And they're failing. They're destroying themselves. They're destroying the planet. Nagarjuna did that. I mean, it's nothing new to me. It's not my new thing, but Nagarjuna, Tsongkhapa, that's been done in many countries where they had, you know, Hindu Vedic fundamentalists. Just like here we have biblical fundamentalists who say, global warming, no way. I don't see it in the Bible. With a straight face. I mean, they believe that. They think, oh, yeah, there's no global warming here. There's no globe here, I might say. You know, there's no solar system. You know, there's a flat earth. I mean, come on. So anyway, That's a political thing. For your point of view, so these are the three things. But now we're looking at Tantra. I want to, before we stop, I want to look at Tantra. Oh, we have time. So I want to get, I want you not to be discouraged about your sadhana of Tara. Where's a copy of your sadhana of Tara? Does somebody have a copy? You have to do it every day, you know, that's part of the commitment. You have to read through it, and there's ways to speed it up, because you're all busy. If you'd give it to me, I'd like to go over it a little bit with you to help you. Oh, good.
That's Tara.
And Medicine Buddha, and, oh, good, Medicine Buddha and Tara. So let's look at Medicine Buddha first. Okay, that's the 21 homage. Oh, great. Bodhisattva vow, rejoicing, excellent. Bodhisattva vow. Come on, where's the Medicine Buddha?
Medicine Buddha, the other.
Okay. Now, okay. The vase of Vaidurya. See, that word Vaidurya means barrel. So it's got to be sapphire because it's blue. Blue barrel is sapphire, right? Pindurya. It's not lapis lazuli. Okay. So, way alone, committed with heat waves, suffering of transmigrating beings, who blossoms the Kumuda flower of unspecified mental being, prostrate the Bhagavan Guru Medicine Buddha. So, okay, first thing you do is mentally bow to Medicine Buddha. And actually, in doing your daily practice, to take three bows at the beginning of it toward whatever. Imagine Medicine Buddha is there, or a picture if you have, it's a good idea. It's a very good exercise, a prostration. You know how to do it, right? You've all been doing it? You all got it? So that's very good. Then, so then you talk about, here's where you begin, you know? I know limitless sentient beings without exception seek refuge in the shelter of three jewels. May I place all migrant mother beings? I like to say migrant because it's such a big thing now in the Congress. Meanwhile, we're all migrants or transmigrants. We migrated here without visas by being born, by kindness of the of all those Ellis Island mothers. On the level of the King of Medicine, on the level of, on the exalted state of the King of Medicine. Okay, that's fine. So some sort of take refuge in the three jewels, reciting three times. And then may I place all beings in the state, at the stage of the Medicine Buddha. May I bring them all into the realm of the Medicine Buddha, something like that. That's very easy. You know, you can get a little notebook yourself or your iPhone, and you put on it refuge three times, establishing the Medicine Buddha practice three times. Refuge and establishing Medicine Buddha practice. You just put like a phrase like that, and you remember this after you recite it several times. And then these are the four immeasurables. May all sentient beings have happiness, cause of happiness. May all sentient beings be, and it's always good to put, may all mother sentient beings have the happiness and cause of happiness. May all mother sentient beings be free of suffering, cause of suffering. May all mother sentient beings be never separated from perfect happiness without suffering. And may all mother sentient beings remain in measureless equanimity, free from the attachment aversion of some close, other distant. Fine. That's the four immeasurables. Then you just put four immeasurables. And those are four states of contemplation, contemplative states, actually. Then, you know, there's all this thing, this sevenfold, sevenfold thing. You know, then you write down on your cell phone sevenfold preliminaries. Okay, so though you already did two of them. You did prostration and refuge. Then you have offering. So you make a list, prostration, refuge, offering. He doesn't have here, but it usually includes. This is a very good devotional offering, but the point is prostration, refuge, offering, repentance of sins or unskillful evolutionary acts, rejoicing in the virtues of others, 5, requesting the Buddha not to, medicine Buddha, not to leave for a dualistic nirvana, not to leave town, give the teaching, request to give the teaching, that's 7, and finally dedication of the merit. Like, may whatever I did that's good today, whatever I do today that's good, be go toward the merit of it, go toward my attaining Buddhahood for the sake of all beings. That's dedication of merit. And so you make a list of those 7, and when you're busy, you don't necessarily have to recite exactly this word or that word. You just think, you know, like, for example, prostration and praise. You could sort of combine those two, you know. You think, oh, medicine Buddha, you're great, and I bow to you. Then you think, I take refuge in enlightened beings, and which you can't do unless you can imagine there is such a thing, of course. So anyway, but you could always take refuge in the Dharma, which is reality, which is the real refuge. So you just say, I take refuge in reality, that someone discovered reality, they taught me how to do it, and there's a community going to help me how to learn to do it. I take refuge in that way. So you just sort of, in your own words even, you think those things. Then you just imagine any great thing, just give the world away to the enlightened beings. Just give it your everything. The whole world, whole universe, every beautiful thing in the universe you can think of. Then think of, oh, I did stupid things, I'm sorry, I don't want to do them anymore, I won't do them again. Do that, then think, oh, all you other people did great things. Even though I myself did some good things in the past, and I rejoice in any good things. Then, please stay with me, Buddha, hang out. Then, see to it that I have a chance to learn, and then dedicate the merit. And you just sort of go through this mentally. You can do it waiting in line, you can do it commuting, you can do it, sometimes you sit down and you read this kind of things. Get used to doing that, that's very good. But you may oftentimes not have time. You may just jump up and be late, gotta go run here. Then you gotta sit on a bus somewhere, then you can do it. So you get used to going through this cycle, right? Then, here's the visualization of the medicine Buddha in his palace. And this is good to sit and read when you have a chance to do a meditation in your time. And you visualize this thing, you know, in the sitting there, and upon a full moon, there's a lattice of rainbow light rays. You're not really thinking necessarily of a physical palace, but you can. And then you invite into what you visualized, into what you visualize. Oh, how nice, a flower petal. You invite the actual medicine Buddha that you visualize to come there. So you remember, I just had a vision of medicine Buddha sitting there. And that vision that I had is like somebody making or doing a drawing of a medicine Buddha or making a picture in my mind, even though I didn't stay there stably because I'm not a veteran meditator. But I have a sense of the presence of medicine Buddha. Then I think the real one sent a duplicate and comes in there, so it's really there. It's a step like that. Then there's a bunch of praisings. Then, you know, I think you might find, forgive me, Gana, but I think you might find reading these Tibetan words and this whole thing a little bit cumbersome. And really what you need to know are the 7, 8 names, the 8 names of the 8 medicine Buddhas, are their original names. And I'm against translating their original names into English. In Tibetan, they did translate the polysyllabic Sanskrit words into monosyllabic Tibetan. Understandably, also, they did that in Chinese. But in English, English is a polysyllabic language like Sanskrit. Do you know what I mean? And we don't say, in the Bible, they don't say Abraham means a compassionate father. You know, and make it into like a seemingly unreal person. We use the name Abraham. Abraham, you know, Rahim. Raham is Semitic for compassionate. And Ab means a dad. Right? But it's a name, Abraham. So these people have short names, these Buddhas, like Manju Kirti, you know, and this kind of thing. And I think I do have a version of the short medicine Buddha sadhana with their Sanskrit names in it.
Page
I think
44.
I can email it to anybody who gives me an email. Somebody, do you have an email list collected, all of you? No? Is somebody collecting an email list?
Page 44 has a list of Sanskrit
it's
names.
A what?
Page 44.
Page 44? Oh, good. Let's see.
Bob, what were you were going to say, though, about translating them, that you don't like to translate them?
Yeah.
Why?
Where is it, page 44?
You just passed it.
Oh, this is good. This is the Sanskrit names. Good for you, good for you. Again, like whoever compiled this. Suparikirtita Namasri. Swargosharaja. Gosha, it should be. Gosharaja. Swaragosharaja. Say Swaragosharaja. Suvarna Bandha Vimala Ratna Prabhasa. And you know, you can just take the last part of it. Suvarna Bhadra. Ashokottama Shri. That's fine. Dharmakirti Sagara Gosha. Abhijna Raja and Vaishajya Guru and Shakyamuni is not here. So those are the seven brothers, and then Shakyamuni is the seventh one. So this is, you know, you should make Suparikirtita Nama, you could just say. Shri just means glorious, it's like sir, you know. Swaragosha Raja, Suvarna Bhadra, you could say. Ashokottama Shri, you know what I mean? You sit down and write down no more than a four-syllable name, more or less. Like Abhijna Raja is five syllables. That's fine. Vaishajya Guru, one, two, three, four, five. That's five syllables. So you have eight five-syllable names. And you go, Nama Suparikirtita. Nama Swaragosha Raja. Nama Suvarna Bhadra. Nama Ashokottama Shri. Nama Samrakirti Sagara Gosha. Or just Sagara, you could say. Nama Abhijna Raja, Nama Abhijna Guru, Namo Shakyamuni. I'm just trying to say, you can sit down and read all these long things when you're really ready to do that. But then what happens is you get busy. You have to go to work. This kid has to be fed. Whatever, the dog has to be fed. You have to go buy cat food. Whatever it is, then you don't do it for a few days. Then you feel terrible. Then, oh, should I start doing it again? Then it gets kind of rusty. Then it sort of fades away. Do you follow me? So I'm saying, I'm trying to forestall that by having you make up for yourself out of this the very key essential things. You know, and the basic key essential things, like, for example, the Kala Chakra is even much more complicated than this. But then there's a short Kala Chakra where you sit down. You know, and this is an unexcelled yoga tantra, so you visualize yourself. You become a one-faced, two-arm Kala Chakra, blue color. Then in space in front of you, you see the guru indivisible from the actual Kala Chakra. But you see him as Vajradhara, one-faced, two-arm, with the universal mother in union. Then you think positive thoughts about him. Take refuge or offer, whatever it is you have time to do, but basically just there. And then the real one is there. Then you think the real one came there because I imagined it there. Then it comes and sits on top of your head. Then merges with you. Then you dedicate that to all the beings around you. Bing. Done. You've tanked up. It's like, you know, in-flight refueling. You know, of a stealth bomber. You know, you come up, and then the big fuel ship is there, and there's the nozzle dangling out. You come and attach the nozzle and pump in the rocket fuel, and then detach, and then continue your flight. So it's in-flight refueling, and you get Medicine Buddha up there, and then Medicine Buddha merges with you, blesses you, comes on top of your head, the eight of them. Then you can add to that whatever elaborate thing you can develop, and you can have full sessions where you sit and do it. And then you feel you've kept the continuity, because the key thing, mind you, remember, everything is gradual, bit by bit. And so you gradually do something to connect yourself to the process of more and more becoming close to Medicine Buddha, bringing Medicine Buddha close to your clients if you're a healer, your loved ones, if you're just a person, want to be a healing person, whatever it is. And it's a gradual thing. And then you'll be surprised. Sometime you'll be doing that and you'll be sitting in the bus or whatever. So be careful when you're driving, you know, visualizing things. But otherwise, you can repeat mantras when you're driving. That's fine. But don't necessarily visualize when you're driving. You want to be visualizing the road. And but when you're riding as a passenger or something like that, you know, you've been doing this month after month, it just becomes like a road thing for you, and then one day you think of Medicine Buddha, and wow, it's like you really see Medicine Buddha there for a flash. You know, you have a feeling, whoa, it'll happen. Or you'll have it in a dream, you know. But the key there, it won't happen because you sat for 1 weekend and 12 hours a day recited the Medicine Buddha. And then exhausted on Monday, went to work and practically relieved to go to work. It's less stressful than doing the sadhana. Shouldn't be like that. Should be short. You do short practices. Another key thing for ongoing practice is whatever you do, quit while you're ahead. Meaning, if you're meditating a little bit, if you're doing a bit of mindfulness and you begin to get a little groove with it, stop. Don't go because, well, I said I was going to do 23 minutes and 42 seconds, so I'm going to do that. And now I'm really bored with it. I'm just watching the clock, but I'm going to keep doing it. If you do that, you won't go back to it. What you do is you do it, you know, if it's a few minutes or however long you have, and then when it's going well, you stop. You dedicate the merit and stop. So that then you kind of want to get back to it, if you follow me. It's like a cliffhanger.
Episode is part of the Buddhism 101 series, using classic teachings from the archives of Robert Thurman to elucidate basic concepts of the tradition, originally recorded at Menla Retreat, summer 2014. To watch video versions of classic episodes of the Bob Thurman podcast, please be sure to follow Tibet House US on YouTube. And now back to Bob and this week's episode.
The Tibetan way of learning is to memorize something without bothering to understand and then get an explanation so that then you understand and then you fit it into what you have in your memory, the words. That is an overall process mm-hmm. that they have. And that's a very valuable process because when you memorize something, like you memorize the eight Buddha's names, for example, that's why I keep them to 4 or 5 syllable names and memorize them. And then you can recite them anytime, and then when you're meditating, they'll all come to you, you see. So memorizing is useful. Mm-hmm. And but, you know, to just keep reciting something that you don't understand without taking trouble to understand it, that's no good.
Right.
You know, there's getting used to a certain recitation, and then cultivating the understanding of it and fitting it into what you've received, the tradition. That has a value. Absolutely. There are different versions, mm-hmm. and you can play around with different things. However, you know, since you grew up in the Catholic Church, and then you're used to confronting images of Jesus and Mary and saints and things in churches, so things in front that are representing holy things, to have a holy Medicine Buddha in front of you, to add that to the list. And that's why Dalai Lama is not in favor of people changing their birth religion. He's in favor of adding to it. And someone like me who wasn't much into it, he says, well, some people can't help it, never mind. But even those people, he says, make sure you don't think, oh, that doesn't work. Don't think negatively and disparagingly about your birth tradition because it's deeply imprinted in your unconscious. Talk about gradual repetition. You don't remember when you were little repeating things, hearing them over and over again, being dragged to this or that place. Maybe you didn't like it and you loved growing up and getting rid of it. but it's still part of you, you know. It is. It's in there. And so you gradually adding to it is the key thing without sort of pushing it away and freaking out about it. Just adding medicine, blue medicine Buddha, you know, and then overcoming the idolatry of established religions, perhaps what I consider the conceptual idolatry.
Right.
In other words, they're not open to a vision of a blue Buddha. They're not open to this thing. Only it can be this thing and that thing, you know. Muslims call Christians idolaters because of the crucifix being always there and Mary and so on. And they you know, right, they in their churches, they have nothing but geometric patterns, right? Because they feel that people get attached to them like idols, you know.
Right.
And they're freaked out about that. So that, you know, there were traditions in Buddhism like that too. But I think when you're doing this, it's best to follow it some traditional way. And if you get some shadow of a reminiscence of something from your Catholic background, don't be so freaked out by that. Because when you say that no longer works, that doesn't work for me. The fact that you're having to hold it away and it blocking something else means it's still working on you, at least, it means. And so it's better to healthily acknowledge that and try to shape it into something more helpful than just sort of try to shove it away, if you follow me. We're not seeking, you know, that the intelligent people, I think, in religions today are not seeking converts. They're seeking people to use what they have in their minds and consciousness in a better way. Just like when you go to a shrink, you don't start having to worship Sigmund Freud. You know, nobody says, oh, now you have to worship Sigmund Freud, right? But you go and you don't have to be adopted by Sigmund Freud, although you're going to be projecting your parents' archetypes on Sigmund Freud. Or if he's your shrink, I mean, you know, whatever. You know. Mm-hmm. Some other weird beardless modern American or female shrink with no beard. So it won't be Sigmund. But I'm just saying, please try to think through that a little bit and think of the Dalai Lama's good advice there. That, you know, what has long been imprinted into us by our childhood, we should develop a benevolent relationship to it, a loving relationship to it, see its value and virtue. We don't have to necessarily reconvert back to something we formerly left, for example. I think he's not going to that extent. But the idea that layer in my unconscious of all that imprinting, they were doing their best, you know, maybe that I have to expand it a little bit. I have to not be so rigidly stuck about it. I don't want some nun coming and whacking me with a ruler on my knuckles.
Right.
Because I scratched my, you know, pubic hairs or something. I don't know what we associate with these. The thing in front is what you were initiated to deal with. Then it merges within you, just melts into you, and you feel a sense of connection to it in the usual sadhana of the medicine Buddha. There are other levels of it where you sort of, you yourself become medicine Buddha. And that's an important level. And that's very threatening to the absolute otherness of God and this sort of modern theologies that they have going, which are, I think, somewhat unhealthy. I agree with you. I personally do say that. But I restrain my own critical sense about anything but rigid absolutisms and orthodoxies and dogmatisms in Buddhists or non-Buddhists. I try to. Okay, following the Hamas view. I was a little rougher in the previous time, I can say. Mm-hmm. In my own critique of it, in my dialogues with my theological friends and colleagues. And I do personally feel that, for example, Christianity has to overcome, and they have to change the theology about how no one can get to heaven except through Jesus Christ. That's just too chauvinist. Jesus Christ can help you, but Buddha can also help you. Krishna can help you. Even, you know, Walter Cronkite can help you. Sigmund Freud can help you. A lot of people can help. Mm-hmm. And to say that everybody else goes to hell creates a subliminal, rigid exclusivism that is dangerous in the modern world, I consider. So, and it's not that theology is rigid. Theologies can be more inclusive or less inclusive, you know. It's not like, you know, Jesus said, I am the way and the truth and the light, for example. But he was saying that to a Jew who was going to uphold on him the Torah and the law, and you can only eat this food now, and you can't heal somebody on the Sabbath, and you can't do that. Then he said, I'm doing what I do, and I'm the way to do it, in relation to that. He wasn't talking to Buddha or to some Hindu, some saintly Hindus, or some Taoist or whatever. He wasn't. So for them to extrapolate from that, that all other of spiritual teachings are false, is shortchanging their own God. You know? I remember a Lama I was translating for in a theological thing was talking to some guy on this topic. And he was saying, why, how come you guys have, your deity is omnipotent, right?
Yes.
So he can do whatever he wants, right?
Yes.
So how can you insist he only has this one son and this one culture speaking this one language? And then a lot of complicated theology about the logos and all kind of thing. So then the Lama gets a little like overwhelmed with that. But then he says, how many children do you have?
Six.
You have six, but you only allow God to have one? A boy? He's asking again. Well, then more about the logos. So this kind of went on and on, all different ways. He was trying to hope that the guy opened his mind that maybe Jesus, you know, was a woman in India. I mean, manifested as a woman, had a daughter. God had a daughter for India or whatever. You know, he was trying to like open his mind a little bit. The guy absolutely couldn't get it. So finally he mutters to me in Tibetan, this elderly Lama, he said, I guess the old boy only had one bullet in him. So then, of course, I laugh, but inadvertently I'm laughing. Then he gets very nervous, the guy. So then I made up something about it. He said, well, I guess it's no point worrying about it. I tried, but he knew it. He knew that was something he wasn't getting, the guy. I didn't dare translate it. So closed-mindedness in general is a problem. And any way you want to play with it, of course, is good. But it's good to try, you know, what you do. It's a form that has come from ancient time, been able to help many people who had many strange ideas too. And it's found to be helpful. So it's good, worth doing. And then if you don't understand something, then find out what it means. And try to do the traditional thing. But also, what I'm urging you is just try to find a very short, compressed thing that you can carry on your iPhone and just look at it and say, okay, yeah, refuge, medicine Buddha thing, medicine Buddha's up in front, then medicine Buddha blesses me, then I feel illuminated, then I bless all the beings around me, then I dedicate my merit to them, bing, bang. It all dissolves into me, and then I dissolve into the beings, and that's dedicating it, and on with the day. So you have a way of failing that you're keeping up the connection. Is the idea when you have time to go through it, you know, prostration and praise, refuge, right. Bodhisattva vow, Bodhisattva mind in relation to the medicine Buddha sadhana, then offerings, then repentance of evil doings, then rejoicing in the good doings, then request for teaching, then request not to attain nirvana, then dedication of merit for the sake of all beings.
Right, and then you said,
and then the being in front, then the receiving the blessing from the being in front, then the being in front being inhabited by the duplicate of the real one, not just your imagination one, so you know, making your fantasy more realistic, then your visualization more realistic, then receiving the blessings of that, then radiating out the blessings that you receive and you know, overflowing with them to others. And then you can do that by dedicating where you dissolve yourself into light and you merge with all the other beings. That's something I like to do at the end of a meditation. And then you come back to your ordinary, being your ordinary self. So those are the absolute minimum sort of things, you know.
What's the Cliff Notes version?
And with the Medicine Buddha, I really think the eight names that you salute them, that could be in the beginning part where you first recognize and prostrate, that you salute the eight names. Suparikirtita Nama Sri, Swaragosha Raja, Suvarnabhadra, Vimalaratna Prabhasa, I like more syllables, but you don't have to do that. Ashokottama Sri, you know, the glorious, supreme joyfulness, you know. Dharmakirti Sagara Gosha, Abhidnya Raja, and Vaisarja Guru. You know, I think those are really lush and nice to recite. Now, the two truths or I prefer to call them two realities, or the ultimate reality and the relative reality, right? So that's just a typical, very important, actually, Buddhist metaphysical framework. You know, absolute and relative. So by the power of the truth, two truths, and by the blessings of the power of the two truths. So that just, so that's pretty, blessings is pretty easy. And then the power of the two truths, meaning it's really referring, therefore, to the power of the accurate and liberating philosophical teaching that the Buddha left. Really, it's like saying by the power of the, by the blessing of the power of the teachings, really. Just among teachings, he refers to cardinal teachings of the two truths, or two realities, as I prefer. Here you have four truths and two realities, I think is better. Keeps it more clear for you. Then, and anyway, this is a pure land, actually. This is Shakyamuni's pure land. Although it seems to be full of problems, but it's actually Shakyamuni's pure land.
With George Bush?
Huh?
With George Bush.
Yeah, even with George Bush. He has the same birthday as Dalai Lama, you know that.
No wonder they like each other.
Yeah, somehow. He doesn't like George Bush's behavior, but he liked him personally. His policies, he says, he doesn't like Dalai Lama. Well, you have to learn the mudras from the Lama. You know, they're like that. You think of offering goddesses coming out of your heart, making offerings. I don't know why they make the goddesses do all the work. Typical chauvinism. Bunch of divine waitresses out there making the offerings. We should send out some guys all dressed up in uniforms. One thing I can say this, you know, you said about things you don't understand. For example, E.B. Cowell, C-O-W-E-L-L. There's a book published by Dover Paperback from E.B. Cowell. You're not making notes. How are you going to learn it if you don't take notes?
I'm recording every word you said.
Oh, you're recording. Oh, someone else is taking notes for you. Good. That little gremlin in there. Okay, good. E.B. Cowell, it's a Dover Paperback called Buddhist Mahayana Texts. And it's a reprint of some old English thing. But anyway, it has in it descriptions of the Buddha pure lands, like Sukhavati, especially the Amitabha one, to the Western paradise. It's supposedly when you look at a beautiful sunset, you're supposed to imagine this like ruby, blissful paradise, you know. And very popular in Asia for millennia. And but reading those things is really great. Then there's another book translated by Thomas Cleary. It's called the Flower Ornament Sutra. It is published by Shambhala Publications, 1,600 pages in English, the one-volume version. And reading these things will amaze you about the visual imagination from the Indian culture, from the Buddhist Indian culture. It's so rich. It's extraordinary. And it will thrill you, really, if you take the patience to read it. And, you know, the way that it's almost blindingly vivid, the way they describe things. And like this little four-line thing here, you know, lattice of intermingled rainbow light rays in the sky. So that gives you, that's a good visualizational jolt if you sort of try to think about what that might mean. And Tribe Lamu Teng, Keng, you know, then Lamu. Again, those are the divine waitresses. If you learn the Tibetan, of course, then you're really learning something, and it's a beautiful language. Very concise, contains a lot of meaning in a few syllables. And then, you maybe don't know what Nirmanakaya means? Do you know what Nirmanakaya is? You do know that. Oh, good. That's the one why the old Lama had trouble with this thing about the soul Jesus, you know. Because enlightened Buddha manifests as many bodies as beings need to be manifested. Why would a compassionate being, although Buddha, it's always denied that Buddha's omnipotent. There's no such thing as omnipotent Buddha. But I like to say omnicompetent to respond to people's needs just as they need it. So it can actually manifest the body. That's because you're this inconceivable being who's like Vidra married to Frank Converse, you know, where you are infinite already, you know, and you are merged with the sub-level of infinite energy in the universe, the clear light energy. That's the substratum or the sub-fabric or the sub-texture of the universe. So you can manifest out of that sub-texture anything you want, because your will energy is distributed everywhere. And actually, you don't want to manifest anything yourself. And what creates the will to do it is the need of the being. The being wants something, so then you'll manifest what they exactly need. Not exactly necessarily what they want, but what they need. So, for example, the Nimanakaya includes, if beings, you know, like Obi-Wan, remember in Obi-Wan in Star Wars, when the Death Star destroyed the planet with 7 billion people on it? And Obi-Wan was riding with Luke, and he felt a disturbance and a shudder in the force of the 7 billion beings being killed by the Death Star having destroyed the thing. If Obi-Wan was a Nirmanakaya of the Buddha, they would immediately create him, manifest himself as another planet to give rebirth to those beings, better than they had before. He wouldn't just sit around shuddering. I mean, he would shudder, of course, but then the shuddering would then create manifesting a whole planet, not a person, but a planet, you know, and a solar system if necessary. It's that extreme, the Mahayana Buddhist vision of Buddha's abilities, what a Buddha means, what a Buddha is. But the just short of omnipotent is very key, though. Rejecting the idea of an omnipotent being. And talking, actually, to the one in the Buddhist literature, he talks to God, and called Brahma in India, the creator God, which other people in India think is the creator, talks to him. And he says, like, well, you created it. How does it work? And Brahma says, no, I didn't really create it. I just showed up first. After the big emanation of this round of the universe, I was the first person here, and I was wondering where everybody was. And then they all showed up. And then when they saw me, they said, oh, Dada. And at first I said, I'm not your Dada. I just was here first. And then they looked all distressed. So they said, okay, I'm Dada, everything's fine. But then when bad things happened to them, they got really mad at me. So I'm tired of that. So Buddha explained to them that we're all co-creating this universe. They actually wrote that down 2,500 years ago and was not burned at the stake by those people who believed in that omnipotent deity in India, showing you where India was as far as being more advanced than Fox News. Then, you know, you have things like yakshas. Yakshas are kind of like giant trolls, you know. Giant troll type of entity beings. But in this case, they're working for the good guys. Yaksha lords. Sugata means one who has realized bliss. It's the name of Buddha. Sukhamgata. They use words of motion to go for words that of understanding, where we use the static stand under. Because of our authoritarian culture, you know, doctrinaire and dogmatic culture, we think understanding means you stand under something. But in the Sanskrit, understanding words are used the verb to go. You go into a new world. When you understand something new, the world changes. And you go into that new understanding, that new experience. So sugata means sukham gata, gone, literally gone to bliss, meaning understood the bliss nature of things. Sugata, name of Buddha. I don't like the word empowerment for the translation. I like the word consecration or initiation. Empowerment comes through the Tibetan translation of the Sanskrit word abhisheka. The word abhisheka means anointment. I like the anointment of a crown prince. You know, well, it's so long ago, but I was a little kid when Queen Elizabeth was anointed. You know, they dumped some, hopefully, like root or some Yves Saint Laurent perfume on her head, you know, to be the queen, you know. And that's a consecration. And the empowerment gives the idea that you get some sort of juice, you know. But it isn't that. You get the door is open for you to learn and practice and expand your sense of being. And the power comes from yourself. I'll never forget the Dalai Lama in India. giving an empowerment of Tara, precisely, actually, what they call a blessing, a jenang. And therefore, this is a little different level than the Wang Kurwa. And he said, you know, we're doing now the blessing of Tara, the blessing initiation of Tara, but, you know, the point is I can't give any blessing, he said. The blessing is in your mind. He said, you're the one, but I create the circumstance where you can then let the blessing emerge from your mind. Because, you know, there's this thing of outer Tara, inner Tara, secret Tara. Outer Tara is Tara, you know, one of her forms. Inner Tara is your own wonder-working, compassionate activity. And secret Tara is, I don't know, forgot. I think deeper level of your wonder-working secret ability. And the sort of surface level and deeper level. And so, again, the Tara one is where you see Tara in front, I think. And again, she comes toward you if you invite her, and she comes to, I don't know the sadhana, whichever particular one it was, and she sits on your head and then merges with you, I think, something like that, right? It doesn't give you, the initiation you had, does it give you the permission to think of yourself as Tara?
What
it does or doesn't?
To me, it's not clear.
What?
To me, it's not clear.
Well, no, it doesn't, because it means that she melts into you, and so you are one with her, but you're not supposed to think of yourself physically as Tara. But there is another level of Tara where you do that. But this permission or this initiation or consecration or blessing doesn't do that, which is fine, because she still melts with you. You're still one, but you're not yet thinking, I'm Tara. And the reason for that is that you're getting started in all of this, you know. And the different level in Tantra of the I'm Tara thing, which is called the adoption of a Buddha identity, you know, is another level than visualizing a Buddha world. It's where you sort of imagining yourself to be this. And this, you know, Carl Jung was very worried about it, others, you know, this would lead people to inflation and megalomania and a psychosis of thinking they're somehow some sort of divinity. And so you have to have that knowledge of relativity and the constructedness. The knowledge of emptiness and relativity is not a knowledge that things don't exist. It's a knowledge of the constructedness of things, that things are, the way they exist is you're responsible in some extent to that structure. You interact with others in doing it. It's an intersubjective, idealistic worldview, but you yourself are responsible for that. So until you realize that whatever your identity, what's your name?
Martin.
So your Martin identity is something that you continuously maintain and construct. It isn't something that's sort of an absolute object in you or an objective subject in you, subjectivity in you. It's something you continuously reinforce and you create, you shape. And even part of it is you're thinking that you're always the same person there when you wake up the next day. Part of it is that illusory level of unchanging continuity. So until you've seen the relativism of that, it's not considered safe to think, I'm Tara. You follow me. So don't do that too much. But the Tara is one with me, blessing me, comes into my heart, radiates blessings through me, that's fine. That's what you have permission to do. Okay? Helpful? But you do get to later, if you pursue it, learn more, you'll get into where you're like a green person. Shifting back and forth from your current. We are not really white. We're sort of blotchy pink. One other thing, I want to say one more thing. However, I know it's all over, but I'm saying one more thing. Kenla is, he is a Rime teacher, that is to say, non-sectarian, non-partisan teacher, which I think is really important. And but one of his main mentors in all of this is the Guru Rinpoche, Padmasambhava. And I just want to say, although I'm sort of a Tsongkhapa-oriented person philosophically, but I really do appreciate Padmasambhava. Actually, the famous Nyingma yogi, whose name was Shabkar, there's a beautiful, Matthew Ricard and his team did a beautiful translation of his biography and some of his poems, songs, Shabkar. He was told by Padmasambhava that Padmasambhava himself incarnated as Tsongkhapa, among other Everybody in Kanya did Tsongkhapa, Manjushri and everything. But Padmasambhava also did. So I just want to pay respect to Padmasambhava, who I really like, and I think he's really great. And ha-ha! I brought another one. I want to pay respect to Padmasambhava. And His Holiness Dalai Lama is very, very fond of Padmasambhava. And all Tibetans are, you know. And actually, therefore, Western people shouldn't get all sectarian out, whether they are Nyingmas or Gelugpas or Kagyupas or Sakyapas, whether their teachers were. And if any of the Tibetan, sometimes some Tibetan teachers are quite sectarian, actually, due to their personal history and whatever, and their short-sightedness, I would say, not following Dalai Lama and Genla's example of being non-sectarian. So I just want to urge you all to do that. Menla itself is completely non-sectarian and helps everybody, just like Guru Rinpoche.
Weekly interstitial music provided by Tenzing Chogyal. All rights reserved. Used with the artist's permission. To learn more, please visit his website at tenzingchogyal.com. This podcast was brought to you in part through the generous support of the Tibet House U.S. membership community and listeners like you. To learn more about the benefits of Tibet House membership, please visit tibethouse.us. To learn about special intensive retreats and programs with Robert Thurman and friends at Menla, please visit menla.us, located just 2 hours north of New York City in the heart of the Catskills. This is podcast producer Justin Stone Diaz, thanking you for tuning in this week. And reminding you, if you're inspired by our work here, and the work of Tibet House US and Menla Retreat, please be sure to like, follow, and subscribe on all your favorite social media platforms. Thanks for tuning in, and Tashi Dalek.